Good evening and welcome. My name is Karen West, and on behalf of Book Passage and Dominican University, I'm so pleased to welcome you tonight. I have just a few comments at the start of the evening. I've just been with the family, and to see the three generations together, swoon. It is amazing. It is amazing. So you are in for a real treat this evening. I wanted to alert you also that on Wednesday, April 25th, we will be celebrating the culminating celebration of our One Book, One Marin with Michael David Lucas and the Oracle of Istanbul with Michael Krasny in conversation here at 7 o'clock. Come support this very vivid, wonderful book and the community event that's been ongoing across the year. We don't want you to stop reading the book just because we're having a culminating celebration, but it is a wonderful, wonderful Turkish treasure. And I hope you've read it, and I hope you'll show up. And also, I get the pleasure of announcing to you something exceedingly rare to put on your calendar, but you can't get tickets yet, but it's going to be September 25th. We're going to welcome Salman Rushdie here for his only Bay Area appearance for his long-awaited memoir. He's going to write about those years of the fatwa, and we are going to be here for him. So tickets will be available. Your best option is to join our website, get on our email newsletter, because we'll send out an invite to you, and that's how you will know to enroll. So now do that thing where you dig around in your bags, your jackets and everything else, turn your cell phones off, and hold on. It's going to be an extraordinary evening. Thank you.
Welcome. Welcome to the Leadership Lecture Series, hosted by Dominican's Institute for Leadership Studies, in partnership with Marin's independent bookstore, Book Passage. My name's Nicola Pitchford. I'm Dean of the School of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences here at Dominican. Oh, good, I'm glad there are some arts and humanities and social scientists out there. And I'm also a board member of Dominican's Institute of Leadership Studies. The lecture series is a program of the Institute for Leadership Studies, which is Marin's Leadership Development Center. The Institute is an incubator for leadership learning, ideas, and actions. Through research, education, and training, community leadership projects, and public forums like this event tonight, the Institute helps people become better leaders. The Institute for Leadership Studies hosts public forums to engage students, the campus, the community, in socially relevant discussions. It is inspired by effective leaders in a variety of disciplines. The Leadership Lecture Series is a key forum seeking to highlight acts of leadership across the disciplines, featuring leaders in the worlds of business, politics, literature, the arts, psychology, civil rights, government, and entertainment. The Leadership Lecture Series is a cooperative program with Book Passage, Marin and San Francisco's own independent bookstore. And we want to thank Elaine and Bill Petrocelli, owners of Book Passage, for inspiring the San Francisco Bay Area for over 30 years. So let's patronize our local independent bookstores. And it was on this stage earlier this year that Bill Bryson said, Book Passage is the best bookstore in the world. And also we would like to thank publisher Riverhead Publishing, a company of Penguin Publishing, for their partnership to help bring us our featured speakers this evening. And of course, our thanks and our warm welcome to Annie and Sam Lamott, Marin's own. It's a thrill to welcome them to Dominican's campus. It's a special privilege for me to guest MC tonight's lecture on behalf of Dominican's School of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences. You may cheer again. The School of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences offers undergraduate degrees in 13 majors from art to psychology, as well as an interdisciplinary master's program in the humanities, and we welcome adult returning students in our evening program. AHSS plays a key role in Dominican's mission to connect classroom learning to the good of the community through engaged learning activities. And I'd like to take a moment to promote two of our upcoming community events in the performing arts here in this space. The first is our guest concert series. And if you're a fan of this wonderful leadership lecture series, I invite you also to become acquainted with our world-class guest concerts. They're on Sunday afternoons throughout the academic year. The final concert of the 2011-12 series is on Sunday afternoon, April 22nd, right here, 3 p.m. There are flyers in the lobby. Violist Jonathan Vinokur, who is principal viola with the San Francisco Symphony, will be performing, accompanied by our own faculty pianist, the wonderful June Choi Oh. We also host, as I hope you know, one of only two programs in the country that offers a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree in dance in partnership with a professional dance company, Alonzo King's Lines Ballet. And our BFA dancers will be performing here in Angelico Hall on Saturday, April 28th at 7 p.m. and on Sunday, April 29th at 3. Those events are free and entirely open to the public. Again, you'll see posters, flyers in the lobby. Please do join us. The lead sponsor of the Leadership Lecture Series this academic year is Private Ocean, which is one of the oldest and largest privately held wealth management firms in Marin. Through the sponsorship of Private Ocean, we've been able to invite the community to 13 programs this year. Thank you to CEO and founder Richard Stone and to Susan Dixon, COO of Private Ocean, for their community engagement. And without their support, it may be obvious to say we could not host the Leadership Lecture Series here. In addition to the live performances, most of our speakers allow us to post the video and podcast of their performances. As of last week, our lecture series YouTube channel has been visited 130,000 times. Also, Penguin Radio, which is online radio at radio.dominican.edu, provides podcast recordings of these events, which are accessible at the website of the Institute for Leadership Studies. Also, you can view these lectures on Community Media Center of Marin's educational channel 30 on Wednesday nights at 8 p.m. And finally, I'd like to thank the staff who have made this evening's event possible. Many thanks to Jen Krengel and to Dominican's student host ambassadors for volunteering to serve as ushers and greeters this evening. And now it's my privilege and honor to introduce Susan Duval Dixon, who is partner and chief operating officer at Private Ocean Wealth Management, our season's lead sponsor. Dr. Duval Dixon's 20 years of business management experience have been coupled with her extensive community service, as well as earning an MBA in strategic leadership from Dominican University of California. She also holds a doctorate from the University of San Francisco in organizations and leadership. Dr. Duval Dixon currently serves on the board of directors of 10,000 Degrees, which provides guidance and scholarships for underserved youth. She is president-elect of the Junior League of Napa and Sonoma, a member of the Financial Women's Association of San Francisco, and a member of the Women Leadership and Philanthropy Council here at Dominican University of California. So please welcome me in welcoming, pardon me, please join me in welcoming Dr. Susan Duval Dixon, who will introduce tonight's special guests.
Thank you, everyone. I've really been looking forward to tonight because I myself became a grandmother when my daughter was 18. And I think tonight will bring back some old memories and probably reveal some parallel experiences that I share with Anne and Sam. Anne Lamott grew up in Marin and is an important contributor to our community. Her books have entertained and inspired us. A college student on a tennis scholarship at age 17, Anne blossomed into a best-selling writer, often called the people's author. She is Marin County's own heroine as the recipient of many awards, including the Guggenheim Fellowship and an inductee to the California Hall of Fame. Her 12 books have sold millions. Miss LaMotte is the author of the New York Times bestsellers, Grace, Eventually, Plan B, Traveling Mercies, and Operating Instructions, as well as two other works of nonfiction, seven novels, including the trilogy composed of Imperfect Birds, Rosie, and Crooked Little Heart. Her 12th book, Some Assembly Required, chronicles her son's first year as a father and her own evolution from mother to grandmother. Stunned to learn that her son was about to become a father at age 19, Anne began to journal about life during the first year of her first grandson's life. By turns poignant and hilarious, honest and touching, Some Assembly Required is the true story of how the birth of a baby changes a family. Please join me in welcoming best-selling author and longtime Marin resident, Anne LaMotte, and her son Sam LaMotte, who is currently studying industrial science and doing a major in product design. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. I love this hall. I'm so honored to be here. And it's our last night on tour. Tomorrow I go to one more place in Oakland, but Sam has been absolved of his responsibility. We've been together a lot. It's been great. We went to the East Coast and did five or six cities there. And then I was on the Midwest, and then we've been doing them again here. So and the miracles were still speaking. And we just keep looking at each other and going, we're still speaking. So I'm just all of a sudden, my eyes are adjusting. I can see friends that are here, my brother, my sister-in-law. So I think we'll do what we've been doing, which is to say we'll just read a little bit from, I'll tell you a little bit about the book, and then we'll each just read a couple pieces. And I think really people love questions and answers, so we'll leave as much time as possible for that. And Jax is here somewhere and may or may not make an appearance. He's having young love. He's got this fabulous babysitter, and he's so uninterested in either of us at this point. But you know, we can't compete. She had little cars, and we didn't have little cars, and we're not adorable young women. So I'm pretty. I turned 58 yesterday. So that's kind of amazing. And I was realizing that when I first started doing the Book Passage University, where Dominican was involved, it was summer or fall of 1985, because I remember I was still drinking. Isn't that funny? And we had a great season, and then in 1986 I got sober. But we used to just take over this campus, and with about 25 people, about 23 of whom were also drinking. So that made it more fun. So anyway, let me just tell you really briefly about this book. It's called Some Assembly Required. It's a sequel to Operating Instructions. Sam wrote a preface where he talks about how my editor had asked me if I would ever do a sequel, and I'd said to Operating Instructions, I said no, I thought it would be exploitive, and he said it wouldn't be if we didn't exploit anyone. And that was so interesting to think about. And then I mentioned it to Sam because I was actually working on something, and I didn't particularly want to do it. Operating Instructions was just so contained. It was just what it was. It was one little book that I wrote for Sam, 20 years ago. And Sam was really into it because the book had meant so much to him growing up, because it's so so written from my heart to his, and it's so written with the intention of preserving these moments and memories and the frustration. I'll just read you a couple lines from his preface. Jax, when you read this one day, I want you to know the love, laughter, and incredible messes of the most memorable, astonishing, an incredible year of your mother's life and mine so far. I can't wait for you to be able to understand what quirky, loving, loyal characters make up your family and friends, how much we adore you and how much we mean to each other. It's an honor and a pleasure to be your son. I don't know how I got so blessed to get you as my son, and I wanted you to have a book like Operating Instructions that's all your own. So, it's the exact same format as the other book. It starts in pregnancy, and it ends on the first birthday of our darling Jax. And it's kind of kitchen sink in the best possible way. I wanted to do something that had never been done before. I wanted a format that didn't exist, but that worked. And people always ask me if I'm talking about writing, what can you use? How can you do this or that, or can you do this? And the answer is you can do anything you can get away with. If you can keep people feeling that it's fresh and true to the material, then you can do any old thing. So we did any old thing. We did Sam did a lot of work by email. He wrote several set pieces, one about Father's Day, that's my favorite thing, but that he's completely turned on. But this is something like my 16th event in 22 days, so I will never turn on the Father's Day piece. My younger brother is my closest adult, along with Sam, but, older person, old guy. And he got married to my very precious sister-in-law, Annette, and I asked Sam to write a piece about that and to be kind of the reporter for the wedding. I was the officiant. Sam was the best man. And my favorite line is right before, or there's so many favorite lines, but they're all Sam's. One is, I have this dress that I wear for weddings. I think I've done like two, but this would be the second, and it's so outrageous. I bought it at the Great Wardrobe Exchange, the consignment store on San Anselmo Avenue, and it's from the 50s, I think. And it's got this great neckline, and it's got, this will make you laugh, it's got the zippers on the side, so you can't gain any weight because it not only will trap your fat, but it'll trap the back fat. So you have to, and then it always shrinks in the closet just from year to year, because dresses do shrink if they're trapped in stale air. So, but the miracle was I could get the dress on for the wedding. And so I was kind of nagging. People said, how did you get the work out of Sam? Nagging. Bribes and threats, money changed hand, what worked at 14 worked at 19. And so I was nagging him over the phone one day, and I said, how is that piece coming on your uncle's wedding? And he said, it's coming along. And I said, well, have you mentioned how cute and thin I looked in my, it's got sequins, it's very 50s. It's just fabulous. And I said, did you mention how thin and cute I looked in my heathery rose dress with sequins? And there was one of those pauses that if you've ever had a teenager, you know that it's not a good situation. And he said, Mom, will it hurt you very much if you're not the main thing about the article about Steve-O's wedding? So I thought that was so funny. So, yeah, it's all about me. So I'll just read you the piece called In the Beginning that will introduce us. And then Sam, we'll just maybe do two pieces each and then take some questions. So, In the Beginning, My very young son, Sam, became a father in mid-July 2009 when his girlfriend, Amy Tobias, gave birth to their son. They named him Jax Jesse Lamott, Jesse after Amy's beloved grandmother, Jessie, and Jax because they liked the way it sounded. Amy was 20 when she delivered, and Sam was 19. They're both a little young, but who asked me? Sam's birth on August 29, 1989 was by far the most important day of my life, and Jax's was the second. Sam and I are quite close, and I'd always looked forward with enthusiasm to becoming a grandmother someday in, say, 10 years or so, perhaps after he had graduated from the art academy he attends in San Francisco and settled down into a career, and when I was old enough to be a grandmother. I was a young 55. Maybe a medium 55. Let's say a ripe 55 with a child just 1 year past his majority. The day before Thanksgiving 2008, I had heard that Amy was expecting when I got a call from Sam in despair. "Mom, I'm going to be a father," he said. I was silent for a time. "Oh, Sam," I said finally. I said it differently than that. I said, "Oh, Sam." He and Amy had been together tumultuously since his birthday a year earlier, but they had split up a couple of months before, although not, I can see now, in the biblical sense. Amy is beautiful, tiny and Hispanic, with her roots in Chicago and her parents now living in North Carolina. She had arrived in our lives on the morning of Sam's 18th birthday to attend cosmetology school in San Francisco. They had become friends at a camp on the East Coast, stayed in touch by phone and text, and begun a long-term relationship, which I hadn't heard about. One day, Sam told me he'd offered her his living room couch until she found an apartment. "Right," I said when he told me this plan. "I was not born yesterday." "God, Mom," he had said, like, "get your head out of the gutter." She had moved off the couch by lunch the first day. They arrived for Sam's family party at my house at 4 that afternoon, very much in love. My brother Steve-O, his sunny 6-year-old daughter Clara, and his fiancée Annette were there, as was our beloved Uncle Millard, our Aunt Eleanor, our best family friends, including Gertrude, a 90-year-old German who'd always served as Sam's paternal grandmother, and a scattering of cousins. We were all transfixed by this beautiful girl who bounced into the house in tiny shorts that would fit my cat. She is around 4'9" and weighed 90 pounds at the time, with long black hair, huge brown eyes, and a perfect smile. And my first thought was, whom did I invite who has a teenage Hispanic daughter? I thought she might be related to Annette, who is also Latina. Then Sam stepped inside, smiling sheepishly, and introduced Amy to me. A little over a year later, Amy had terrible morning sickness that lasted a few months, and she spent a lot of time taking naps on my couch and nibbling bird-sized snacks. I was happy all the time at the thought of Sam's being a father and my getting to be a grandmother, except when I was sick with fears about their future, or enraged that they had gotten themselves pregnant so young, or in a swivet of trying to control their every move, not to mention every aspect of their future. They moved into a one-room apartment a few blocks from the old studio and created a nursery in a corner of the bedroom. Sam was woozy with pride and scared to death. Amy was clear, calm, and fiercely into becoming a mother. She did things the way she wanted to, which made me, even when it made me unhappy. Sometimes I cried. Sam tried to protect Amy from my neediness and anxieties, i.e. they purposely didn't call or text me for days, and they fought routinely. Amy would threaten to move back to Chicago, which made me crazier than anything, but I would not interfere. And Sam would call in despair, and I would stay neutral with undertones of suppressed rage. And they'd come through their conflict, and I would get to be the beloved tribal elder for having stayed neutral. And here is my son, Sam Lamott.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming. I don't know who dragged you here, but it's not too late to get a late night movie. This is an email from me on August 3rd. Hi, Mom. Here's the skinny on the fam. Jax's fingernails have gotten long again. We clipped them just last week. This is already one of our least favorite things to do. Since last night, he's managed to scratch his face a couple of times badly. A new development is that now when we pick him up, even if he is swaddled, he flails his arms in the air instead of lying passively in baby burrito mode. His hands now open and close, and because he is armed with claws, he scratches everything, including us. Between feedings last night, he was trying to stay awake with us, which was throwing off our schedule, because he needs to sleep, we need to rest, and then he needs to eat again, often every 3 hours. It's like a perpetual motion machine. We loved it at the time last night, because it was so cute to just look at him. Now, however, we are all wasted. This is an email on August 4th. Amy is exhausted from Jax being fussy all night because of the frustrating sleeping, eating situation. I took Jax and let her sleep in, but she isn't pumping her breast milk, so I can't feed him. This makes me sad and mad, not to sound too much like Dr. Seuss. I started thinking about how much I really hate the umbilical cord stump, and I wish I could pick it off. I'm fantasizing about how much easier life would be without it. Bathing, being able to throw on diapers without worrying about it. This damn stump has been nothing but a nightmare for someone who worries and likes to control things. Because it has been spotty, bloody, and not at all cooperating with what I'd like to see there, which is a nice plain tummy. But as I was writing this just now, Jax began to fuss, and I walked over to pick him up. And as I did, this black thing rolls off of him. I quickly realized it's a stump. I should be like, hooray, right? Nope. As I was going over to show off the new stomach situation to Amy, who has been peacefully sleeping, I looked down at where the stump was, and I'm now convinced I could see his insides. I don't think it healed right, and I'm looking at what must be his large intestine. I woke Amy up in a panic, yelling at her to call the paramedics. Jax needs surgery. Amy looks at what I'm seeing and is very concerned, but somehow keeps her cool and calls the pediatrician. During the phone call, I find blood on his fingernails. I've caught him red-handed. He has clawed open his stomach. Plus, it's all our fault because we didn't clip his nails. Amy called the pediatrician's office and nobody seemed to be concerned that my baby's guts were coming out of his stomach. I mean the person on the phone and then the advice nurse who listened to our concerns. There is no emotional change on their part. Are these people desensitized? When I'm convinced my child is dying, the medical professionals trying to sound calm actually have the opposite effect for me. So on the phone, I feel that this is a dire emergency, and my baby probably needs emergency surgery. So these receptionists and nurses should be very attentive and concerned. Instead, they gently convince us that we didn't even need to come in, that Jax was perfectly fine. The small open wound turned out to just be a normal old gooey belly button. They see it every day. We covered it up with a SpongeBob SquarePants Band-Aid. All is well-ish.
There's a lot of pieces about my little church that I've written about so much over the years. St. Andrew Presbyterian, Marin City, you're all welcome. 11 o'clock Sunday, nice and late, so you can eat a lot first and have the Church of the New York Times and then still make it to church. You're always welcome. We have lots of Sunday school. We have me. We have two Sunday school teachers and a nursery for Jax and his colleagues, so... it's a very sweet and inclusive place. You would be welcome. But so there's probably 8 pieces about my church because it's just my favorite day and hours of the week. I just live for it to get back there again. So I eventually got sober there. I converted there. I got sober in 86, and I think I got baptized the next year there. Sam was baptized as an infant in 1989, and we hope to have Jax baptized there someday, but he hasn't been yet. But, you know, I have a mentor I call Horrible Bonnie, and she was very clear that we are baptized with our first breath here, and we are baptized and chosen and beloved and claimed, and that the sacrament is sort of a afterthought. So it actually hasn't triggered me as much as you might think it would to have not had him baptized as an infant. So, but anyway, he and I go to church every Sunday together. This is from October 4th. I went to church crankily because it is stewardship month and I hate the shakedown sermons, but I had to go because I was teaching Sunday school, and Amy and Jax had been away for almost 3 weeks, and it had been to visit her parents on the East Coast, and everyone that she's close to lives in Chicago, and it had been really painful, and we just kind of, he lives in the city and I live in Fairfax, and we kind of gritted our teeth and gotten the time to pass. So, is it really true that everyone, including me, is growing and healing spiritually, whether we experience that or not? It sure doesn't feel that way. Bonnie and Tom both think so, they're mentors, although they point out that growth is not fast, clean, cute, or comfortable. It would be great if God were up there shoving ever-resistant people like me through the maze towards presence and serenity. But no, it's free will 101. This does not work for me at all. Still, I went to church bitterly because of the Sunday school kids. Only there were no kids except in the nursery, so I hung out with Jax's colleagues, Isaiah and Cooper, and their teacher until Jax's absence began to feel like a cavern. I came, I pined, I headed back to church for the dreaded stewardship sermon. And everyone there conspired to ruin my best efforts to wallow in self-pity. The four oldest women with their walkers, wheelchairs, and wigs in the Amen corner snagged me first. Billy Johnson's hair looked especially pretty, and when I commented on this, she said, "Oh, I just found this old one in the hamper." She made me hug and kiss her for so long that I remembered Sam at age 5, unable to part with me one night, heartbroken that I was going out. He said, like a sad little old man, "Let me keep kissing you until I can stop crying." The gentle, tough, crying, laughing, singing congregation is such an unfair advantage on Jax's part. It really sucks. I mean, it's such an unfair advantage on God's part. I just thought about Jax for a second and I read it. Sorry. Sam loves it when I screw up. He notes it because he thinks I make this look easy. So every single time I stutter or... it was such an unfair advantage on God's part. It really sucks. Then Renola sang the lead in the choir anthem, and her voice was as peaceful as the pristine silence of the ashram. It's just the other side of it. There's a lot of stories about this ashram we were visiting down at Hills of Los Altos, too. There was like 12 people and just crystalline silence. It's just the other side of that pristine silence. It's what carves out space so we can rest into what's bigger than us. Her voice, the choir, the quietness at the ashram are paradoxically like burrowing into the snow to make a shelter that covers and surrounds tiny you and keeps you warm. I girded myself against Veronica in her stewardship sermon, and then she preached one of her best sermons ever. She began by talking about the German word for sin, which she said means to separate, to sunder, so that instead of seeing our divine nature, we see our separation everywhere, from one another, from God, from our own souls. It reminded me of a line I've had taped to my wall for years. We aren't a drop in the ocean, but are the ocean in drops. Veronica said that no matter how painful and wrong things seem, Jesus is always playing the music softly in our lives, and we can dance around, because when we dance with one another, everyone feels happier and chosen, and we are dancing with the Godhead of which we are a part. Then she made us get up and dance around. I am not making this up. All 40 of us danced, Evelyn in her wheelchair, Marge Cortez with her cane. A sleeping baby was danced in his mother's arms, and the rest of us held hands or hips in a conga line, or did the foxtrot, or like me, the Bolinas hippie tribal stomp. Ike danced with his oxygen tank. I went home and danced around as I cleaned the house, too happy to contain myself, because on top of it all, coincidentally, ha-ha, almost 3 weeks had miraculously passed somehow, and Sam would be home, God, and Jax would be home tomorrow.
So I really do love when my mom messes up. I bathe in it. And tonight she actually preemptively stole my line about how I love messing her, or how I love her messing up. But that's okay. Let's see. We're having technical difficulties. Okay, no, I got it. Thanks. All right. February 29th, interview with me. Sam, tell me what he is like now, even at 7 months old. He's a totally roaring, rocking, kicking Godzilla child. He's like part of the World Series crowd that's gone wild. He's gotten such focus and will. And then me and Amy have these clashes of will. So it's like we're two alpha male gorillas trying to raise Godzilla. What really has changed in the last few months is that the buck really stops here, with me. The problem has to stop at this chain of command. I'm not going to turn over my problems to you, to my mother, and say, I just can't take it anymore. Now I automatically feel, let's just get it done. Before I could perfectly imagine an elaborate drawing or plan, and then stall forever on creating it. Now I know I need not put it off. With a horrible diaper, before, I might wait for Amy to discover it and deal with it, which was chicken shit. Now, like I said, the buck stops here. Just do it. Boy, we've come a long way from those first black tar poops. Now they're pretty human. Kind of manly. Now, because he's so grown up and can do so many things and engage with us, I think, why am I wiping some other guy's ass? What's wrong with this picture? Before, he was so helpless, but no more. I tell him, I am not going to be doing this for much longer. Today, he was on my lap being happy and playful with me for a long time, and then he wanted to crawl off and do his own thing. I let him go. Wow, now he wants to go somewhere. Before, there was no somewhere else. Now he might want to go to his bouncy saucer, and he totally wants to, with conviction, like when he's one of the dogs that wants to go out. He doesn't give up or forget about it. It's like he's going, hey dude, what does it take for a guy to get put in his bouncy saucer around here?
So I think there's a couple of people with mics. If you have any questions, we're really happy to answer them about anything, writing or faith or real life or really anything at all. Everybody for 20 plus years, the first question has always been, how is Sam doing? So now it's sort of throwing everything off because everyone can see how he's doing. So sometimes the first question is sort of hard to think of. Yeah.
First, thank you both. I buy operating instructions in bulk. My husband says I come up to the bookstore checkout and they're like, oh God, here it comes. So 30-some women are all over the world are crying over Baby Sam. I'm also a writer, and I sort of wanted to touch on what you said in the beginning about not exploiting people. I think a lot, actually, when I write about your work over the years and how you have always sort of been able to write about Sam in a way that I always felt seemed very respectful, and it was always very clear that you were checking in with him when he was old enough about what you could share and what you couldn't share. So my question is really for both of you and partially for Sam, how you guys have negotiated that over the years to find a way that you can share enough that it's truthful without sharing so much that you're sharing parts that are not your story but are in fact Sam's story, and sort of how you've managed growing up that way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You want to start?
Well, I didn't have much choice when I was really little. But my mom kind of told me that was normal. Like, oh, all kids grow up on the floors of bookstores, you know. That's just part of growing up. But from about the time I was 10, she always ran it by me. And a lot of the times, I didn't like the first draft. And I thought, wow, you really make me look bad and you look like an angel. And so she'd take it back to the drawing board and come up with it. And then it'd be like, okay, this kind of both makes us look like human. And yeah, I mean, for nonfiction, it's hard because you really have to keep some things close to the chest. It's like, you know, stuff you really have to protect your family from. But if it's a novel, my mom's got great advice for that.
Yeah, I've always told students when I had them that anything that happened to you is really yours. You really get to use anything at all that happened. And if people wish you were going to write a more admiring portrait of them, they should have behaved better. But I have never, ever wanted to hurt anyone's feelings, ever. I've never wanted to expose the family laundry. I so have the goods on all my cousins. And every single person that's close to me knows this, that I don't write about the intimate stuff. I write sort of one or two or three, probably two or three concentric circles out from where my life is really happening, and the intimacy of being a mother, being a sister, being an aunt and a niece. So that's always gone without saying, that I was never going to write anything that Sam would not be glad I'd written later when he was looking at it. We both felt that very strongly with this book, that, you know, it's not a pure journal. It's not everything that happened. It's a book that we really wanted to be able to give as a gift to Jax, so that it was going to be these same sorts of true moments, but really with an eye to everybody being able to feel okay about it. So both of us showed Amy everything. I had her permission before we started. We showed her family everything. And I just, first of all, sometimes people, Sam says all the time, you just got that so wrong. Or else he'll say, you know, you just make up this stuff. And then you try to convince everyone that it's true, which I do. Like, for instance, this is just a kind of dumb example, but I've always been convinced that everybody loves my cranberry spritzers, because I happen to love cranberry spritzers, and it's my main drink for 25 years, is Calistoga with a couple inches of cranberry juice in it and either a slice of lemon or lime. So it's really pretty, has that blush in it, and then either a bright piece of yellow or green. And so we were having a holiday one day, and Sam said something like, oh God, not the cranberry spritzers. I said, everybody loves my cranberry spritzers. And he said, they really don't. It's just usually all you have. And I said, and then I have a little niece who I'm very close to who's 9 now. I said, well, Clara loves my cranberry spritzers. And she said, I hate them. So, but I do make up this stuff. Like, I'll say to people, oh, Sam loves history. He just loves anything having to do with history. And Sam will be going, wait, what? You know, but I believe it. Like, even standing here, I believe that this is true. But I just made it up. So, with a novel, you get to use everything. But you have to disguise it if it's going to be something that is going to put anybody in a bad light. I mean, you first of all, you just not are not here to expose people unless you're a journalist. And you're here to tell your stories. And you're asking people, you're saying, do you have a minute? You want to come sit by the campfire? I've got this story I think you might find interesting. And you don't want to be sued is the main thing. So, but my experience, I've written 7 or 8 novels, is that if you just change people's physical characteristics slightly, they have never once, ever recognized themselves, ever. You can change the color of someone's hair and their height. And because people, it's like me making up all this stuff, people have such a honed, version of themselves that they can live with. So people basically think they're sort of positive and hardworking and on top of their games and stuff. So I had a friend that, this is 25 years ago when I wrote Joe Jones, every single thing out of her mouth was negative. It was just so strange because she actually had this kind of bubbliness about her being, but everything came out like this ugly word association game. So you would talk about seagulls, and she would move to like avian fecal matter, like that. But she'd have a factoid. Or you'd say something about how beautiful the sunlight was, and she would think, she'd start talking about melanoma. And so I made up a character in Joe Jones named Faye, the world's most negative human being, because it was all sort of fun, and sometimes I'd kind of have these little games inside myself. I'd toss her a question, I'd think, how can you make that ugly, you know? And she never once disappointed me, ever. And but I was fond of her. I felt like God had sort of assigned her to me and vice versa. And then when Joe Jones came out, I was very worried. And we were walking along, and she said, I really, really enjoyed it. I thought all the minor characters were really interesting. I said, oh, thank you. She said, you know, Faye, and my heart stopped. And she said, I know someone just like her. And that is over and over and over the truth. So if you have stories you want to tell from childhood or your marriage or whatever, just change the hair color. I always said with men, just change the size of their manhood. Because if it's very, they're not going to come forward and go, that man with the tiny little, that's me. No one ever, ever, ever is going to do it. Ever. So if you change it, the person into somebody who they don't want to claim to be, you're home free. So, and otherwise, I always told my students, write what you'd love to come upon, because that tells you that something in your soul, you know that feeling of reading something, just feeling grateful, just going, ooh, God, I'm in. And that's what is a very good signal to yourself that you're writing something of real depth and that you can really feel confident. Maybe something universal, even though you're going to have the only details that you can tell. So, there's a question in the back. Here comes the mic now.
I have one while they're getting the mic to. My name's Deborah, and I'm so delighted to get to hear you again. I heard you first just after operating instructions came out up in Seattle. Uh-huh. And I had an intake of breath. When Sam came on stage tonight, to see this real grown person and with all the images I had of him through the years, and what a handsome, capable person he is. So congratulations on that. I have 2 children of my own. They're 25 and 27, and I guess your comments about how you interact, and my children will hold up their hands, 1, 2, 3, for how many times they've heard the story that I'm telling about them.
Oh, don't tell them.
Sorry. Yeah. So, as you're telling these stories collectively now for your grandson and son, are there ones that you particularly want him to remember? Oh, see, here it is again.
There's our person. Yes. Here's our Jax. Hi, hon. Hi, sweetie pie. That's the new fiance. Sam, do you want to answer that? It's like having a husband or a wife in that one way that they just have to try not to roll their eyes so that the other guests can see it. But, you know, I have a pretty limited number of stories, and Sam has a limited number of stories, and I just have the perspective of this one slightly eccentric, very left-wing, sort of aging hippie, wavy gravy admirer, and I see things through a certain focus. I've always sought God. I have always understood that something heard me when I prayed, and since I was a little kid, and I was shamed into not believing that because my parents were atheists, but I've always had this kind of other reality that I could go to where it was bigger and trippier and a lot more based in love and the fact that we're loved and chosen. I think my parents forgot to mention that. I think they meant to say, you're perfect the way you are, but it just slipped their mind. And so I spent my entire life until I was in my early 30s thinking, as soon as I do this, or if I could only learn to do this, or if I could only find the right guy, if I could only find this, if I could only get this to happen for me as a writer. And so the big story for me has been when I started to realize, A, it wasn't out there, and it wasn't out there for anybody. And if people looked great and they had a great marriage and they had everything perfect and the perfect Subaru and the perfect everything, that I was comparing my outsides I was comparing my rattled, very human, anxious insides to their outsides that was burnished and arranged, you know, and tricked out by a cute area rug from IKEA. And little by little, after I got sober, I started to understand that all interesting stories were Me Too stories, that all the stories I want to read, I'm going, you know what, that's so strange, me too. No one's ever said it before. I love that, it makes me laugh. And the stories I tell are me too stories, and I think that's why people have responded to my books about being a mother and a writer and a Christian, because what I decided to do was to write what I would have loved to come upon, which is to say, publication will make you way more mentally ill than you already are. You know, it's not the incentive. The incentive is the writing. The incentive is to become a wonderful artist with a dedication and a discipline, because that's the path of freedom. And I chose to become a mother who would say this stuff out loud that it turned out every mother had thought. And it just hadn't been done yet. And so I would say, when Sam was 2 months old and colicky, I'm thinking about bundling him up and leaving him outside just for one night. Because I feel that if I could get one night's sleep, I could handle this. And nobody went, you what? Or that's so crazy, why, you know, that's so angry. And every single mother went, oh yeah, me too. So I forgot the question, but do you have anything to add?
When it comes to my mom telling stories, I'm so good at not paying attention or listening. And I'm really in my head most of the time, even throughout the day, and all my friends think I have a terrible hearing. And I went and got checked, and it's fine. So I'm just really good at tuning people out. And we've had to do this before, but it looks like we have to do it again. My mom will start at A on a question and just end at Z. So if we could get a time cop for like 5 minutes to do a timer, then we'll get out of here a lot earlier.
Well, he's also worried that I don't make sense because I think in terms of tangents, and that's what I love, and those are the singers and the writers I love, and the poets I love who start with one thing, you know, start with some leaves in the garden and kind of trip out and go really far into where we go when we are... And that's how I think. And I was a spaced out child. My oldest friend, Shelley Adams, from when I was 6, and her father, who practically raised me, Dick and Lee Adams. I was this way at 6. You can talk to them afterwards. I was spaced out and I was absent-minded and I maybe was long-winded and I had all these tangents going. But that's what storytellers do, Sam. You have 4 or 5 balls in the air and or 3 or 4 of those, I know I'm being nudged off now, but you have some plates in the air, and that's what a good novelist is doing, is keeping the plates in the air. So, well, let's move on to another question. I think there was one back there. Yes.
Hi. First of all, Jack's over there. I can't wait to read your book. And thank you, Annie and Sam and Jax and I don't know the...
Allison,
thank you all for being here.
The fiance.
I wanted to know if you collaborated on the title of this book and what inspired you to call it Some Assembly Required.
Sam just looked at me and said, how did we get the title? The interesting thing is I've almost never thought of a title. Isn't that funny? I've always had a working title, and one title I did think of was All New People, from the line where the husband's kind of annoyed with the mother for always being so worried, and he says, honey, you know, what's the big deal? 100 years, all new people. And and I thought of Traveling Mercies, which is one of the prayers the older people at our church always say to you if you go anyway. Oh, Traveling Mercies, and it means go with God and be God to anyone who's needful and just let your mind be blown and come home safe and sound, which is like a very great path for life. So, but with this one, someone thought of Operating Instructions, which I didn't think was a great title. Bird by bird, the copy, you know, the copy editors, there's a person in the chain of command who so keeps you from looking like a fool. And this is my 13th book, and the copy editors are the reason I can look at myself in the mirror, because they say, well, you know, it's funny because Uncle Al's eyes are brown on page 27 and they're glistening blue on page 100 when he's crying. And then also all the way through there, this can't happen. This was not a Sunday. And I think, well, of course it's a Sunday. I wrote it down, but you know what? I was a spaced out child in menopause 10 years ago. It was not helpful to the focus and the concentration. And so I just was like, oh, and I make up stuff. So I go, I'm sure it was Sunday. It really wasn't. This takes place in a specific year. And the copy editor is paid to go find out that the Sunday would actually be the 8th, not the 13th, or the whatever. So somebody, my editor, sent a whole bunch of title ideas, and at first I think he sent Some Assembly, and then I wrote back, and we crossed, our letters crossed, I wrote, wouldn't it be funnier to say Some Assembly Required? And he had written back and said, it should be Some Assembly Required. And as soon as I heard it, I called Sam. I just knew. You know, sometimes you just know something. You go, that's exactly the only title it could have ever been. You know, there's a great old Christian line that the soul rejoices in hearing what it already knows. And it's one of my favorite lines, because when you read a line of poetry or you hear a line of music, or even a phrase that your soul longs to have expressed in this world, where most important stuff can't even be expressed. Uh-oh, he's looking at his clock. It's such a relief. And when I heard Some Assembly, I just knew. I just went, that's a title. And when I called Sam, he knew. And we both, so that's how it happens with...
She's probably making up the part about adding required.
Yeah. No, I'm not. I'm not making up that part. But thank you for sharing. So one or two more questions, if there are one or two more questions. Yes, in the front row, you can just say it and I'll repeat it.
My process for writing is just not to write to get published. It's just sort of to like journal and write and just keep things that you want to keep for your own life. And I've always had a good writing voice, and my punctuation always was terrible. And so teachers, either because they were scared to give me a bad English grade or something, they always really liked my writing voice, and they just got over the fact that my punctuation sucked.
Yeah. Yeah. You could his writing was always beautiful, and the punctuation sucked. And it turned out that you can't just try to drill it into people. Everything you try to get your children to do by force is something they need to resist. So, but now we're both on Twitter. He's capital Sam, capital Lamont, because there's somebody out there, maybe she's here tonight, named Samantha Lamont, who took the lowercase Sam Lamont. So he's uppercase, and I'm Ann Lamont, but I don't think I'm any case. Am I any case? No, I don't think so. But so he'll show me this stuff he writes sometimes. It'll be brilliant, and the punctuation sucks. And I'll say, well, I think it would be better if you put a comma there, because a comma serves a purpose. You stop for a second, right? You go da-na-na-na-na, and then you go on to the rest of the sentence. And so I can still feel him just going, oh, my God, when will this end, dear Lord? But that's just the way it is. You know, we're like you. We're imperfect, and some days are just too long. And as my friend Tom says, and sometimes we get mad at each other, and I will invade his space, or I'll be convinced that my ideas are really, once again, excellent ideas, and that if he, and in fact most of the world, including the subcontinent of India, would listen to my ideas, we could organize and things would go better for everyone. But I have 58 years now of knowing that that's not truth, that any effort to control and manage will result in a lack of harmony, but I still try. I'll just say one last thing, and maybe this would be a good thing to end on. It's a very eccentric book, I think you'd have to admit, if you read it. There's a long passage on my trip to India, which just blew me away like nothing ever did. But once again, I learned that for some of us who are black belt codependents, and girls raised in the 50s to be perfect girls, which I was the goodest girl ever, really. I know some of you think you were, but I mean, I was mixing drinks for my family at about six. You know, I could make blender drinks, and I had a little caseload. My parents weren't doing very well, and I tried to work with them, and I just believe that if you listen to my ideas, it will help you. And the main theme, I would say, of this book is someone trying to stop controlling other people, including her son, her daughter-in-law, and an infant. Good luck. But I have learned through the grace of having other women like me, grandmothers, that I'm really responsible for what's inside of my own hula hoop. But when you're a parent, even in an aunt and an uncle, you just keep your fingers kind of tremble with the joy of going into someone's life and picking up, you know, and cleaning up, organizing. I went to India and I thought, look, we have got to get organized here. This is a mess. You know, but I didn't have a clipboard or any post-its. And these other women, through grace, have taught me to kind of grip myself by the wrist and breathe and say my little calming prayer, which is about trying to help me let go and not leave such deep claw marks. And it's one day at a time, and as I said, some days go better than others. So a lot of the book is me trying to learn that Sam is on his own hero's journey. You know, he was 19 when he and Amy had Jax, and Amy was on hers. And what you want to do as a parent is to get on their path with them because of your good ideas and this tiny addiction around trying to control other people. tiny and hardly worth mentioning. And I want to run alongside him on his hero's journey with my clipboard and my post-its. And the book is about how one day at a time we release people to the care of their higher power. We try not to stand between them and their higher power, the only source of healing and discernment and true connection, and how we try to surrender into the care of our own, one day at a time and in community. And so thank you. This has really just been such an honor to be with you here tonight. And we just loved it and love you. So thank you.